From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After writing the screenplays for The Color of Money, Sea of Love, and the Martin Scorsese segment of New York Stories, Richard Price has returned to novel writing. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk about his new novel, Clockers. It's about crack dealers and cops. He spent time hanging out with both while researching his book. Also, some background on the fighting between the republics of the former Yugoslavia. We'll talk to Ivo Banets, a professor of history at Yale University and a native of Croatia. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Strange Loyalties, the latest novel by William McIlvaney that features Glasgow detective Jack Laidlaw. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The morning after he'd captured enough delegates to guarantee the Democratic nomination for president, Bill Clinton addressed a meeting of TV network affiliates in Los Angeles. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports.
If none of the three candidates can capture a majority come November, the choice of president falls to the House of Representatives. At a meeting of television executives in L.A., Democratic candidate Bill Clinton said he hadn't given much thought to a proposal to ask Congress to go along with the popular vote.
I do not believe that by the time this election rolls around, it'll be thrown into the House of Representatives.
Clinton said the defection of two top Republican and Democratic staffers to the Perot campaign demonstrates not bipartisan support, just the Texas billionaire's ability to buy good political help. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
With barely 22 weeks left before the November election, neither the Bush nor the Clinton campaigns wasted any time at the end of the primaries. Both campaigns took swipes at Ross Perot. Clinton charged that Perot has been a professional political operative for 20 years. Republican National Chairman Richard Bond said voters will reject Perot after they've looked at his contradictory statements on taxes and political hedging on subjects like abortion or gun control. President Bush announced plans for a primetime nationally televised news conference tomorrow. Only cable news networks said it would air the news conference live. CBS, NBC, and ABC said they would not. Clinton arranged for an appearance on the Arsenio Hall show tonight. The AIDS epidemic could spread throughout the world much faster than expected, according to a new study. A Harvard-based group has compiled fresh information and estimates of the epidemic's toll. It predicts anywhere from 40 million to more than 100 million adults will be infected with the AIDS virus by the end of the decade. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
The numbers are so high they lose their meaning. But what is clear, says the Global AIDS Policy Coalition, is that the world is quickly falling behind in the fight against AIDS. The independent research group released today the first of a planned series of annual reports on AIDS. Jonathan Mann of Harvard University spoke for the group.
Evidence from around the world supports very clearly the concept that the epidemic is expanding and the epidemic is accelerating.
At the same time, said Mann, efforts against AIDS are stalling. There's been a drop in both money and international cooperation to fight the disease worldwide, and the report lists dozens of countries whose social, economic, and medical problems make them especially vulnerable to the spreading epidemic. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 11 points to close at 3,407. Declines edged advances in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Labor Department said today that the number of jobs lost during the recession was far greater than previously reported. The agency said today that 2.2 million payroll jobs were lost in the recession, about one-third more than the government's previous estimate. Labor Department officials say they're still at a loss to explain how such a huge error could have been made, but they insisted that it was not politically motivated in an effort to make the recession appear less severe. Democrats charged that the job report proved that the economy was in far worse shape than the Bush administration has been willing to admit. Wisconsin intends to crack down on people who move to the state for its relatively high welfare benefits. Governor Tommy Thompson today signed into law a two-tier welfare program. Marge Pitroff of member station WUWM reports.
Wisconsin's aid to families with dependent children, or AFDC, benefits are higher than most surrounding states at $517 a month for a family of three. because of those relatively generous benefits and the fact Wisconsin's AFDC rolls have swelled in recent years, some state officials fear Wisconsin has become a welfare magnet. In order to discourage such welfare migration, the state has approved the experimental two-tier system. Under the program, newcomers to the state will receive the same benefit level they would have in their home state for the first 6 months they live in Wisconsin. Supporters say Wisconsin cannot afford to take care of other states' welfare problems. Opponents claim two-tier will infringe on poor people's freedom of travel. The pilot will begin in 2 years if the federal government grants the necessary waiver. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Pitroff in Milwaukee.
American manufacturers saw another increase in orders in April, the fourth straight gain in a row. The Commerce Department said that factory orders were up by 1% in April, following a revised increase of almost 2% in March. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I wasn't surprised when writer Richard Price first teamed up with director Martin Scorsese, because they both tell stories about the kind of streetwise ethnic characters they grew up with. Richard Price's 1974 novel The Wanderers was about street gangs in the Bronx, where he grew up. He followed that with the novels Blood Brothers, Ladies' Man, and The Breaks. His first screenplay for Scorsese was The Color of Money. He also wrote the Scorsese segment of New York Stories. This summer, two of Price's movies, both starring Robert De Niro, will open, Mad Dog and Glory and Night in the City. Movies kept Price away from novel writing for about 8 years, but now he has an ambitious new book called Clockers about crack dealers and cops. He had written from a cop's perspective in his screenplay for Sea of Love. In Clockers, the chapters alternate between the perspectives of cops and dealers. Before we talk, Richard Price is going to read from Clockers. I'll let him set up the story.
One of the main characters in a book is this kid Strike, who's a 19-year-old drug dealer, who's a sub-lieutenant for this other guy who's an older, more charismatic figure in the community. He's a drug dealer that has Strike and a dozen kids working for him. And his name is Rodney. And what Rodney likes to do is he likes to take five of his young drug dealers for sort of a booster club, Chamber of Commerce-type lunch, where he lectures them on having the right attitude. And the kids never really get what Rodney's saying because they're too young and too immature in their life is, you know, too scattered and impulsive. And Strike is the only guy that Rodney's ever gotten through to, and Strike has become sort of his de facto son and his young prince. And at this point, Rodney has been lecturing the kids for about 15 minutes about bank books and prudence and everything, and the kids are all spacing out on him. And this is Strike's thoughts about what Rodney has just put forth to all the other drug dealers. Strike guessed that he was probably the only kid who had ever received Rodney's restaurant lecture and understood right away what he was saying. During that first lunch a year ago, Rodney's eyes had lit up with gratitude and pride when he saw Strike stay right with him. Finally, he'd saved one. Rodney's other clockers always went down. They were too poor, too immature, a lifetime of one way going up against 2 months of the other way. Other way didn't stand a chance. You got to start respecting yourself. Rodney was still hammering away, not ready to give up. The kid that spends it as fast as he makes it don't believe it's real, don't believe in himself. He's thinking like with a 2 minute clock, thinking like a poor man, like his life is day to day, minute to minute. He got no future because he don't think of no future. Strike watched the kids tune out, dip in fries and ketchup, one by one turning to wave down the waitress and order orange sodas or Cokes, their cognacs left unfinished. You got to believe in yourself. You got to start thinking about your future, and that means you got to start saving your damn money. Hell, they do, Rodney pointed out to the room. There ain't a person in this restaurant right now can't go home and show me a bank book. And you kids making more day by day, week by week than them all, but I'll bet come the end of the month they got more than you do. Rodney whirled his hands around each other, cocking his head. Do you all get what I'm saying? I hear that, Charles said automatically. Rodney sagged with frustration, looking like the old man of 37 he was, then said, well, the hell with it, I tried, and got back to his ribs. Strike was relieved that the lecture seemed to be over, glad that Rodney didn't do his self-image exercise, making everybody come up with a positive word that started with the same letter as their first name. Going around the table, people saying stuff like terrific Tyrone, sexy Strike, rockin' Rodney. 6 months ago, one kid had called himself Brightful Booker and then almost put his fork in someone's chest when everybody laughed. But Rodney wasn't done. He lit up again, tried one last approach. I mean, look at Strike here. The kids did as they were told, Strike looking away as if he had seen something out at the bar. Look how my man dressed. No flash, color coordinated, nice pair of dark Reeboks, none of them paratrooper sneakers you all like to wear. Jump out a window, you bounce right back. No one laughed. I mean, check this out. The narcotics roll up on my man at a red light. What do they see? Because you know they're going to be profiling. They see a kid in a two-year-old Accord, no gold on, nice hair, not no high-rise billboard up top his head, nice dark sweater, probably driving like my grandma. You think the narcotics going to be thinking clocker? Hell no, they thinking a 9-to-5 kid working at First Jersey or some damn thing. Strike's doing it right. Strike's getting over, cause Strike's quiet storm. Strike fumed, thinking lose the Accord. A table of strangers now knowing it's a dope car. And Strike's got himself a safe. Abruptly, Strike rose from his chair. Now they all knew he saved it, which meant he's got it. Rodney getting him killed. Strike stood over Rodney, trying to hold in his anger, keep himself stone-faced and without stammering. I got to book. I got to see my parole officer. As Strike walked from the table, he heard Rodney say, Strike's got like 4 safes. So come knock night, when the narcos come down, they can't confiscate his money. See what I'm saying? I mean, Strike's here to stay. Strike palmed his gut. Lose the safes. Lose the Accord. Lose Rodney, too.
Richard Price, how did you start observing this scene?
Well, in 1986, I was going out with cops in Hudson County, New Jersey, sort of soaking up some atmosphere for Sea of Love. And I got very hooked on seeing the world through cops' eyes, because when you run with cops, you see, you know, humans in such extremists. You get, you never see life on such a life and death level, day in, day out, night times, day times. It wasn't that I was crazy about cops, but I just wanted to keep witnessing, you know, all this human struggle. And at some point, I decided that I would like to leave the cop's point of view and see the world through the eyes of those that the cops deal with, which are the world of the victims, the world of the predators, and all the people for which the cop in the neighborhood coming down very quickly is more prevalent than the mailman coming.
But how did you get connected to the dealers? It's easier to call up a precinct and ask for permission to drive around with cops.
The cops called the dealers for me. It's, you know, in a mid-sized city, the way law and order works, it's real flexible. I mean, everybody needs everybody. A homicide investigator won't solve any crimes if he doesn't have people talking to him. And if you don't do favors for people, people won't do favors for you. And everything is relative. So, yeah, you skipped your hearing and there's a warrant out on you and a cop says, well, I'll fix it for you, but remember my name. And, you know, the guy's going to have to remember his name. Or, you know, the criminal's got a problem, and he'll come to the cop and say, listen, if you can get me out from under the rock, I'll give you a name on something else which is heavier, or I'll turn over the guys that I've been dealing with, buying from in greater quantity. It's all little fish giving up bigger fish.
So when you first approached dealers and told them that you were writing a book and you wanted to follow them for a while, what kind of rap did you give them?
Well, I just met him through the cops. I met him in the homicide office. There's one guy, and you know, we just talk for you. People just check you out, and basically they want to see, A, if hanging out with you is going to put them in jeopardy. B, are you a jerk? I certainly wasn't going to put anybody in jeopardy for helping me out. And I guess I wasn't big enough jerk for them to say no. And, after a three-hour conversation, the dealer in front of the cop said, well, you ought to walk a mile in my shoes. Why don't you come on out with me tomorrow night? I looked at the cop, and he said, sure, why not?
What were the rules you had to follow when you were traveling or hanging out with dealers?
There were no rules. It wasn't like, now I'm going to take you to a place, you know, don't look anybody in the eye. It was none of that stuff. I was with, the baddest guy in town. So it's, you know, it was like, where does a 500-pound gorilla sit anywhere he wants? I'm with him, you know. I'm with Gorgo over here. So, you know, just, you know, don't lose sight of him. You know, don't let him wander off and, you know, leave you alone. I mean, I wouldn't be in that place for a nanosecond without a guy like that.
How would he explain you to other people?
Just say, I'm this writer. You know, I got this writer coming around and, you know, they'd look at him and, you know, everybody got used to seeing me because I was, you know, and, so, you know, at some times I would be like the only white guy around And, you know, if they see a white guy walking around in circles like that who's not obviously a customer, the second thought is that the guy's a cop. You know, so this guy Rodney, the Rodney character, you know, basically had to constantly calm people down and explain to them that, you know, I'm not there. My presence is not a danger to them, and I should be allowed to live.
Richard Price is my guest. His new novel is called Clockers, and it's about dealers and cops. And he's also a screenwriter in addition to a novelist, and his movies include Sea of Love, the Martin Scorsese episode of New York Stories, and The Color of Money. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and novelist Richard Price is my guest. Now, you hung out with cops a lot as part of your research, too.
Right.
And I'm wondering if the cops, knowing that you were also hanging out with dealers, ever tried to get information from you.
Oh, well, the funny thing is that I hung out with everybody so much, people kind of forgot that I was a writer, and they started telling me more than they were telling the guy that sent me to him in the first place. I mean, they were, you know, occupationally adversaries. So he would say, you know, to the cop who sent me over, hey, man, don't tell him this. But, you know, he thinks I'm over here, but I'm really over there, you know. And then I'd run with the cop, and he'd say, well, you know, don't tell Rodney this. But, you know, he thinks I'm over here, but I'm really over there. So in a way, I knew more than, I mean, I was like the girlfriend between this married couple. And it was kind of like a marriage between these cops and these dope dealers. Because, as I said, they needed each other. Every once in a while, somebody would pull a real number on me. Like, I was, you know, my standard fee was like $100 for a sit-down. If you sit down and answer my questions for $3, I'll buy you some drinks and I'll buy you a steak, and you get $100 change. And I sat down with this narcotics cop, and he talked for about 2 hours, and I gave him $100, and he took the money, but he didn't say thank you, and he gave me kind of like a dirty look, which I couldn't figure out. You know, I was a little paranoid. And the next night, I went out with one of the drug dealers, and I spent, a number of hours with him, at the end of which he got his pay, and he started laughing. And I said, what's so funny? He says, yeah. He says, you gave Frank $100 last night, didn't you? He says, yeah, last time I had a meet with Frank, I told him you were paying me $500. You know? So, you know, things like that would happen. But that's what I mean. There was like an intimacy there that, you know, that at its base is potentially deadly and deceptively relaxed. But it's not, you know, you there, drop that gun. I mean, it's real flexible out there. There's not too many oak trees. There's lots of willows.
Did you get the impression that the cops respected the dealers and the dealers respected the cops on some level?
No, it's respect is a funny word. Understood is a better word. I mean, mm-hmm. People understood why people did the way. It's really, unless you're brain dead, if you're a cop and you're out there a certain number of years, you have to have some getting of wisdom about why people are the way they are and how people act in certain situations. I don't think there's a cop in the world who doesn't, deep down inside, understand how a kid can, at 15 or 16, turn into a drug dealer, given what he's seen before that kid had been born in that neighborhood. You know, and there's probably, the more reflective cops always wind up saying, there but for the grace of God go I. If I had been born in this project, I don't know, I probably wouldn't be a cop. I'd probably be like him.
One of your cops in the novel says he's done so many strip searches over the years that there's one guy's underwear who he is more familiar with than his own. What's the etiquette for you when you're standing by watching a strip search?
I don't help. I mean, I just stand there back discreetly, and the kids were going crazy because they couldn't figure out who I was, this sixth white guy in this car that used to come down and make their lives miserable at any time of night or day. And they knew those five guys. They christened them. They gave them their street names. And so when there's a sixth guy that they don't know, they get all hinky because they say, who the hell is this guy? Is this a new guy we have to worry about? Well, he doesn't look like a cop. He's kind of skinny. He looks a little scared. He doesn't have a gun. Do you think maybe he's a special cop? Or maybe he's a commissioner? Or maybe, he's a lawyer? But they were going crazy trying to figure out who I was. And I don't want to make eye contact with anybody because then they're going to see, you know how much I'm really holding it in. And until I finally heard one guy say really out loud, "That guy ain't no cop, man. Look how scared he is." Of course, Richard, you completely fall apart when they say that. But
cops and dealers tend to have their own language. And I wonder if that's one of the things that interests you as a writer.
Oh, sure. You know, I've always been into you know, the way the urban patois, you know, of any group. What I decided to do is that some of these kids were, it sounded like Lord Buckley to me, or somebody you have to listen 10 times before you understand what they're saying. But by and large, I decided to forego, you know, doing the Margaret Mead number and getting the glossary right, because I figured even if I nailed it, you know, by the time it hits the book, it's old news. You know, so I just decided to concentrate on good dialogue, which is to say dialogue which, because of the progression of the words, captures the way that individual metabolizes his thoughts.
Is clockers a word you made up yourself?
No, clockers is a word I heard from a kid in the Bronx and I heard from another kid in Jersey City, but I didn't hear it that often. It basically means the kids get addicted to selling as much as other people get addicted to smoking it. The transaction of bottles for cash is an addicting ritual. And I had kids tell me about how they developed constipation problems because they got so hung up on the money they were making down there. They were holding it in. They didn't want to go upstairs and sit on the toilet and miss all that money. It was an addiction, and they were clocking, which is to say they were there around the clock.
I think the first novel that you wrote was The Wanderers. That was your first, right?
Right.
And that was about gangs in the Bronx, in the neighborhood that you grew up. Do you think there's a connection between your interest in writing about gangs when you were younger and writing now about people who are on the streets selling drugs?
Well, yeah, because I feel like the only... wherever you are in life, you're always only from one place. And for me, that's the housing project's working class background in the Bronx. And the projects have changed so dramatically... other than, you know, the bricks are the same, but that's about it, that in a way I felt like I was going home and starting all over again as a writer after this 8-year hiatus as a screenwriter, and I'm trying to find myself again as a writer, and it's almost like going home, but, you know, home has changed. It's like Rip Van Winkle.
Well, have you literally gone home back to the housing project you grew up in?
I've been around there. It's ethnically it's changed. It's no longer as racially mixed as it was. You know, but, you know, I think it's still a pretty good project. I mean, it looks well kept. And, you know, I know the cops from that precinct. And, you know, and I know that that's one of the, you know, more benign precincts in the city.
I know you spent some time teaching at Daytop, which is a drug rehabilitation center.
Right.
You were teaching writing, reading?
Well, I was volunteer teaching creative writing. I was, I had my own drug problem in the early 80s. And sort of when I... clean myself up, I decided that I should take it a step further, and I went to Daytop to, just talk to the kids that were trying to deal with drugs that was so much more potent and pernicious than the stuff that I fell down on at a such more vulnerable age and with such more hideous backgrounds than I had. I just sort of felt like, let me go in there and tell them, listen, I have it a lot easier than you in this world, you know, and I couldn't handle, you know, 3-cut party coke, and you guys are doing kryptonite, you know. I couldn't handle it, you know, and I'm here to tell you that. And then, you know, from there, I just say, you know, it's sort of like going into an AA meeting and saying, hi, you know, my name is Bob, I'm an alcoholic, you know. I mean, it's like I'm, you know, I was in no better shape than any of them. And then, you know, from there, we go on and do writing exercises, try to get them to do some experiential writing and express themselves.
Did you like that? Did you like teaching there?
Yeah, I did, because it's not the usual. The thing is, I actually probably enjoyed teaching adults and, you know, people in circumstances, educational circumstances like that, much better than I do teaching in a regular, American university, because it's so much more of a struggle for that kid or for that adult to be present in that classroom. It's much more of a conscious choice. It's not that, well, I'm 19 now and I'm supposed to be here, so I'm here. I mean, there's a hunger present in the classroom that I find, much more electrifying.
I think you're probably in the process now of turning your novel Clockers into a screenplay, or has that been done already?
Well, I'm taking a shot at it.
So you're still working on it?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. It's the never-ending story.
So where do you start? You wrote the novel first. Now you're turning it into a screenplay.
What you do, the first thing you do with a book when you make it into a script is throw it out the window. It's what I did on Color of Money. Unfortunately, the book is mine, and I know every line by heart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you're supposed to obviously kill your darlings, but I thought I killed all my darlings, and I still have a 300-page script. It's like Lonesome Dove. so I have a lot of work to do and a lot of rethinking. It's very hard. I mean, what a screenwriter does is reinvent a novel for a different art form. He really doesn't know anything to the novel except to capture the spirit of what the book was about. And what you have to do is you have to take 100 pages of deathless prose and just dump it and think about two or three scenes in 10 pages that will, visually and for that medium in shorthand tell you what those 100 pages he threw out the window told you. And it's very tough to reinvent your own book when you've got it so deeply entrenched in you. I've never done this before. I feel like a cannibal eating his own foot.
Do you think you're making a mistake in trying to do it yourself?
Oh, yeah. But, it's my mistake to make. I mean, there's nothing. Listen, whoever is going to do this book is going to screw it up, and they're going to get paid for it. I'd rather screw up my own book, thank you. I mean, I'd rather, I'm saying this, semi-facetiously. I mean, obviously, I hope to make this work. But, I mean, it's the most frustrating thing in the world is that you write a book and you feel proud of it and it has a certain vision. And then when they make a movie out of it, some guy just goes in there hacking away merrily in his butcher's apron, and you go nuts when you see the finished product on the screen. If this thing doesn't work, I'd much rather be the one that's responsible for its failure than some other screenwriter, because it's the lesser of two pains.
This is the first novel of yours that doesn't come out of your life. All the others were in some way autobiographical.
Right.
Was it movies that got you out of yourself in terms of the subject of your writing?
Well, what happened is that, with The Breaks, I kind of felt bankrupt as an autobiographical writer. I started to feel like I went to the well too many times. And I decided that a solution out of that would be I had all these offers to do screenplays. And I decided, well, you tell me a story and I'll write it. I can't come up with any great epiphanic structures right now. I'm a pen for hire. Whose body do you want me to inhabit? You want me to be a pool hustler? Okay, no problem. You want to be a cop? Okay, I'll be an abstract artist. I'll be, like the Headless Horseman. You just keep them checks coming. And, I'll just sort of refresh myself. I always knew that I would be coming back to writing novels. I do believe that sometimes there are second acts in American lives. And I did. It took a lot longer than I thought it would take for me to get back to novels because... unlike cocaine, screenwriting is impossible to give up. And when you get good at it, the seduction is potent. It's constantly, well, you can work with this big star that you never worked with before and get this big check. You've never seen numbers like this before. And you're constantly, it's like they're throwing all this candy at you and you want to say, no, I'm going to go home and eat my whole wheat toast. I'm going to do my novel because it's good for me and I've got to grow as a person. But, the fact of the matter is that you do. And at some point, I just had enough.
How does it feel to have written a novel again?
It feels great. I mean, I've never been so proud of anything I've ever written.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No, you're welcome.
Richard Price, his new novel is Clockers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, putting the fighting between the Yugoslavian states in historical perspective. We'll talk with Yale professor Ivo Banets. He's the author of two books about Yugoslavia, and he grew up in Croatia. He's returning to Croatia on Sunday. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Strange Loyalties, the latest detective novel by William McIlvaney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Leaders of the European community are scrambling to try and control damage incurred by Denmark's rejection of a new treaty on economic and political union. NPR's John Edstey reports from London.
After a meeting of EC officials in Brussels this morning, the Portuguese foreign minister, whose country holds the rotating presidency of the EC, said the 11 remaining EC countries would press ahead with the Maastricht Treaty without Denmark. Exactly how they can proceed is not clear, since legally the treaty needs to be ratified by all 12 EC countries to take effect. Denmark's veto, of course, makes that impossible. The Danish no also created turmoil in the ratification process in other countries. For instance, France announced it will now hold a referendum rather than simply ratifying the treaty in the French Parliament. The outcome in Denmark is a blow to efforts to create a stronger European government. The treaty called for a single European currency by 1999 and planted the seeds for common European foreign and defense policies. I'm John Edstey in London.
A 12-day Earth Summit has opened in Brazil. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, in an opening day speech to the meeting, blamed rich nations of the world for a rise in the Earth's temperature. But at the same time, he said that poor nations are to be blamed for destruction of their own resources. The UN Secretary General said that the Earth is sick from underdevelopment and also sick from too much development. 15,000 delegates are attending the meeting, held under the watchful eye of a 35,000-member security force. Texas billionaire Ross Perot has not officially announced yet as a presidential candidate. But today, two veteran political planners were named co-managers of his campaign. Glenn Mitchell reports from Dallas.
Both Jordan, who was Jimmy Carter's chief of staff, and Rollins, who ran Ronald Reagan's 1984 campaign, said their lack of faith in the major parties to bring about change led them to accept Perot's offer. Rollins will be day-to-day manager. Jordan will concentrate on overall strategy. But Jordan stressed that part of the strategy will lie in knowing when to leave well enough alone.
The worst mistake that any of us could do would be to try to come in and tinker with what's here. It's very special, very unique, very powerful. The challenge for us is not to change it, but to understand it and to contribute to it.
New Perot campaign advisor Hamilton Jordan. For National Public Radio, this is Glenn Mitchell in Dallas.
President Bush will hold a news conference tomorrow night in the White House East Room. It will be only his second primetime news conference in 3 years. ABC, CBS, and NBC will not carry the news conference live. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 11 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The government of Bosnia has once again called for military aid from Western Europe. In a statement, government officials said that the fighting is growing worse and charged that the Serbian army is getting reinforcements. In the past, European leaders have turned down calls for peacekeeping troops but have imposed economic sanctions on Serbia, which has been accused of keeping the fighting going. There are also UN sanctions against Serbia. Last night in Sarajevo, Serbian and Muslim factions fought with heavy machine guns and artillery. The city has been under siege for weeks now. Greece's prime minister has conceded his government breached UN sanctions against Yugoslavia by allowing 60 oil tank trucks to cross the border. Pierre Vickery reports these trucks were then impounded by Macedonia.
The affair began when customs officials in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia inspected a convoy of 60 tankers at Macedonia's border with Greece. The tankers were impounded when they were each found to contain about 30 tons of oil, in violation of the United Nations embargo on fuel exports to Serbia. Prime Minister Mitsotakis blamed the incident on what he called an inexcusable bureaucratic error, insisting that Greece fully intended to implement sanctions, irrespective of whether it agreed with the measures being taken against its old ally, Serbia. Greek customs officials are now reported to have tightened inspections of all vehicles heading north towards Serbia. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vicory in Zagreb.
Factory orders were up 1% in April. That's the fourth monthly increase in a row. The Commerce Department also says that factory orders in March grew 1.9% instead of 1.6% as announced earlier. April marked the longest string of advances since orders climbed for 6 months in 1988. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's easy to see how tragic the fighting is between the republics of the former country of Yugoslavia, but it's been very difficult for many of us to understand what the fighting is about. So we asked Yale professor Ivo Bonets to help us put the conflict in historical perspective. Bonets was born and raised in the city of Dubrovnik in Croatia, and he's the author of two books about Yugoslavia. The multi-ethnic state of Yugoslavia was put together after World War I. It was occupied and split up again during World War II, but was reassembled in 1945 under Marshal Tito, who ruled until 1980. Yugoslavia started breaking apart after the death of Tito. That was accelerated by the collapse of the Soviet Union. Bosnia-Herzegovina, Slovenia, and Croatia are now recognized internationally as independent states. Macedonia is seeking recognition. Serbia and Montenegro have joined together and call themselves the legal successor to Yugoslavia. Serbia has launched offensives into Croatia, Slovenia, and now Bosnia-Herzegovina. It's hard to sum up what the fighting is about, but we asked Professor Bonets to try anyway.
What it's all about essentially is the struggle over the heritage of the moribund Yugoslav state. You have constituent republics, which have, in several cases, proclaimed their independence. And they are defending the territories that have evolved over a very long historical period, not during the post-war period, as is occasionally claimed. Now, the activist element in the whole story is Serbia. Serbia has a very specific problem. Namely, it has many co-nationals in the other republics that, from the point of view of the dominant ideology in Serbia, should be included within the Serbian state. Now, this does not, of course, operate in the same way in all of the former Yugoslav republics. There are hardly any Serbs in Slovenia, therefore the issue does not arise there. But there are Serb minorities in Croatia, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and according to some theories coming from Belgrade, in Macedonia as well. And it has been the policy of the current Serbian government to try to wrest those territories in which these Serb minorities are well represented from the republics in which they find themselves and to attach them to Serbia.
Are Serbians who are living as minorities in republics outside of Serbia afraid that they will be oppressed?
This is precisely what they claim. And if there are, and there have been, historical incidents that would suggest that these relations could not be ultimately harmonized, this particular point of view can be defended, although I don't think that it can be a priori proven. What has happened in Croatia and in Bosnia-Herzegovina has been, I think, to a very large extent, an attempt to conciliate the interests of the minority Serbs in these republics. But apparently nothing is well enough for a political program that really cannot be satisfied except by inclusion in the Serbian state.
Bosnia-Herzegovina is half Muslim. And
almost half, yes. Mm-hmm.
And there's an Islamic government in the,
not
in the country.
Right. What emerged in Bosnia-Herzegovina after the elections in 1990 was a coalition government in which the three parties of the three constituent nationalities were equally represented. What has happened in the meantime is that the Serbian third of that coalition government essentially has withdrawn from it and is creating a separate political organization on the territory of Bosnia-Herzegovina. So the current government is, to a large extent, a Muslim and Croat coalition in which only those Serbs who do not agree with the program of the Serbian Democratic Party, the dominant party in Bosnia-Herzegovina, participate. And these, unfortunately, are not as many as one would wish.
What do the people of Bosnia-Herzegovina want?
Well, that depends to which national group they belong to. And therefore, a single aspiration cannot be really deduced at the moment. I would say that the aspirations of the Bosnian Muslims are to keep Bosnia-Herzegovina as a unitary and independent state. And this is something to which the Croats also subscribe. But I think that the majority of Serbs really do support the insurgency of the Serb Democratic Party, aided by the Yugoslav People's Army, and would like to wrest the territories, which are predominantly Serb, away from Bosnia-Herzegovina and to unite it with Serbia. But this may not be possible, since, after all, they represent only a third of the population of that republic. So far, they have had extensive success, mainly because the balance of forces is not evenly distributed. The Serb national group in Bosnia-Herzegovina is heavily armed, is supported by Serbia, is supported by the Yugoslav People's Army, and this is not and this is an advantage that, of course, the other constituent groups in Bosnia-Herzegovina do not have.
Now, some people say that this war has been caused by Serbian aggression. Others say that the war has been caused by the repression of Serbs. Do you think it's one way or another?
I don't think that it can be said that the Serbs were repressed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. If anything, they had a decided advantage in that their demands were being met whenever they were possible. Of course, one can never agree to, from the point of view of Muslims and Croats, to the dismemberment and the abolition of independent Bosnia-Herzegovina. So the Serbs are not repressed in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and I don't think it can be claimed that they were repressed in Croatia either. The real active agent in the whole conflict is precisely the government of Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia that has, to a very large extent, manipulated the aspirations of the Serb minorities in the two concerned republics. And I think that it can be claimed that whenever the government of Serbia decides to halt this operation, that in fact it would be halted. It has that influence over the events. The events are not as chaotic as the spokesmen of the Serb minority in Bosnia-Herzegovina have claimed.
Tell us something about the background of the Serbian president, Slobodan Milosevic.
Very interesting individual who comes from a relatively obscure background, meaning that his position in the Tito's hierarchy was not particularly prominent. He comes from a ecclesiastical family. His father was a Serbian Orthodox priest. His mother, however, was a communist and a school teacher. What is particularly interesting in his family background is that both of his parents committed suicide. This is suggested in some quarters that he too, in a certain sense, is conducting a suicidal policy.
My guest is Yale professor Ivo Bonitz. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the fighting in the Yugoslavian republics with Yale professor Ivo Bonitz. What does the word Yugoslavia mean now? What is Yugoslavia now?
Well, there are two points of view on this. One point of view is that Yugoslavia is the state that existed till its constituent republics moved away from it and therefore no longer exists. This is the point of view in Slovenia, in Croatia, in all the other successor states that have proclaimed independence. From the point of view of Serbia, what has happened is that Yugoslavia was left by any number of its republics, and therefore Yugoslavia is what remains. It is the remainder. It is the rump of the old Yugoslav state. And this is precisely what the government of Slobodan Milosevic had in mind when, at the end of April, it proclaimed the establishment of the new Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, consisting of Serbia and Montenegro, but very suggestively stated that this particular new federation is open to any new members that wish to join it. I think what this essentially meant was an invitation to the Serb groups in Croatia and in Bosnia-Herzegovina to continue carving out territories of these republics and to join them to this new Yugoslav state. The international community does not recognize that this new Yugoslavia is in fact a linear successor of the old Titoist Yugoslavia. In fact, the recognitions to Milosevic's Federal Republic of Yugoslavia have not come, with exceptions. And although this issue has not been resolved in the United Nations, where the so-called Yugoslav delegation still sits, I think that ultimately it will have to be resolved, because this is not just a political issue, it's also an issue of it's a legal issue, and it's an issue of a disposition of certain state property. For example, who is going to own any number of different buildings, embassies, and so on, that the old Yugoslav state had abroad, moreover in vast quantities.
I'd like your opinion on the UN sanctions against Serbia, and the UN identified Serbia as the principal aggressor in this war.
I think that this was the least that could have been done under the circumstances. It's very likely, and in fact I'm certain, that this came far too late. It's not clear whether the sanctions by themselves are going to change or influence Serbia's course, which would suggest to me that it's quite likely that at some point either the United Nations or the wider international community will have to consider military intervention. That does not necessarily mean a full-scale invasion, but that could mean engagement in various other ways. For example, blockade of the harbors of Montenegro, part of the Serb-Montenegrin state, or the jamming of air communications, which would deprive the Yugoslav People's Army its advantage in air warfare, and so on and so on.
You know, many people have said, well, since there's no oil in the Yugoslavian republics, the United States doesn't feel it has the same involvement as it did, say, when Iraq invaded Kuwait. What are, though, the international possible repercussions of this fighting in Yugoslavia?
Well, there are many. First of all, they have exposed the disunity of the Western countries over issues that are entirely too close to home. And this in itself, I think, is a negative effect. Many differences within Europe, at the time when Europe was thinking of integration, were exposed precisely in the context of the Yugoslav events. But more importantly, I think that it is a very bad precedent, especially in Europe, and especially at the time when there are vast changes in the former communist world, to stand by and permit one particular leadership that is quite out of control to gain advantage through what is essentially aggression. Therefore, if the New World Order is to be more than a pretty phrase, I think that there is a great interest on the part of the international community to bring this to a very quick end. But let me go beyond that. The Yugoslav developments, I think, have a great possibility of spilling over the southern borders of former Yugoslavia. The issue of Kosovo, which I think is a ticking bomb within Serbia, is very likely to involve Albania at some perhaps not too distant a point. Greece and its peculiar attitude toward the recognition of the Republic of Macedonia is, I think, also a very likely spot that might have a spillover effect, since other countries in the neighborhood, specifically Bulgaria and Turkey, are also interested in this issue. Greece and Turkey, as you know, are NATO members, and their relations have never been well ordered. I think that further contention between them over the Balkan issues is likely to have devastating effect in the NATO alliance. So you can see, I think, that there are many linkages here that all suggest that something has to be done very quickly to bring this fighting to the end before the already catastrophic course becomes even more catastrophic.
You're going to Croatia on Sunday. You grew up there. How has your family been affected by the war?
Many of them have been obliged to leave Dubrovnik. Many of them have spent months in temporary shelters. My wife's family, for example, was exposed to a naval bombardment on an island where they reside only 10 days ago. So quite obviously, I have many friends and family members who have been very much affected by all of these developments, and one necessarily has to express tremendous sympathy for them and, whenever possible, to offer them comfort.
Is your family shocked by the fighting, or is it something that they always expected could happen?
I don't think that anybody expected the situation that we have now. I think that in extraordinary circumstances, certain demons are released, and they always surprise relatively peace-loving people to encounter massacres that, for example, have been committed quite casually in Bosnia-Herzegovina during the past couple of months, is beyond the wildest imagination of anybody who has watched the building of the current conflicts. So there is a surreal aspect to these developments, and one feels as a result profoundly uncomfortable and somehow out of balance faced with such developments.
Are you referring to the fighting in Sarajevo?
I'm referring to the fighting in Sarajevo, but I'm also referring to any number of other scenes of combat that are less familiar. Sarajevo, Dubrovnik, Vukovar, and so on have a certain recognition value at the moment, but there are many, many obscure places where equally horrid things have happened, and which unfortunately did not have the advantage of presence of journalists and television cameramen in order to show to the world the nature of this particular conflict.
Ivo Banets is a professor of history at Yale University and the author of the books The National Question in Yugoslavia and With Stalin Against Tito. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Political news tonight. Ross Perot has hired a couple of top political operatives, Hamilton Jordan and Ed Rollins, to run his campaign. Jordan's a Democrat. He worked for President Carter. And Ed Rollins is a Republican. He ran the Reagan campaign. Also, an anniversary story tonight. It was 50 years ago that Japanese planes launched an attack against Dutch Harbor in the Aleutian Islands, the only attack against North American territory during the war. It was a two-day raid. 35 Americans were killed. The Aleutian campaign went on for another 15 months. Here's the second part of the story. The native Aleut people were soon evacuated from the Aleutians to southeast Alaska.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As you may know by now, our critic Maureen Corrigan reads a lot of detective novels. She just finished a new one by William McIlvaney. He writes about the Scottish detective Jack Laidlaw. The first Laidlaw mystery was published in 1977, another came out in 83, and now, 9 years later, there's the third, Strange Loyalties. Maureen has a review.
The terrible crime that's uncovered at the end of the new mystery, Strange Loyalties, is nothing compared to the crime that the publishing world has committed against author William McIlvaney. Strange Loyalties is McIlvaney's third novel, featuring the hard-boiled Glasgow detective Jack Laidlaw. The second novel in the series, The Papers of Tony Veitch, is in paperback. But if you want to read the first novel, entitled simply Laidlaw, you'll have to become something of a sleuth yourself. It's vanished, without a trace, out of print. To understand the heinousness of this offense, imagine that it's 1954 and you've just discovered Raymond Chandler through his latest novel, The Long Goodbye. You're told that there are other great Philip Marlowe novels. But then imagine learning that The Big Sleep, the novel that introduced Marlowe, is no longer in print. Realizing that you can't get the first Laidlaw book makes you want to go out and pistol whip a publisher. Detective Inspector Jack Laidlaw is the sharpest mind to be hatched in Scotland since David Hume, and he's a damned sight more entertaining. He fills his empty hours away from police work, drinking too much Glenlivet and reading Camus and Unamuno. As he explains to us, "I read quite a lot of philosophy in a slightly frenetic way, like a man looking for the hacksaw that must be hidden somewhere before the executioner comes." In Strange Loyalties, Laidlaw has taken a week's leave of absence to set out on a tortured personal quest. His brother Scott has just been killed in an auto accident. Scott was once a gifted painter, but his ambitions died long before he did. Laidlaw can't accept that his brother's life and death were meaningless. By discovering the demons that haunted his brother, Laidlaw hopes that maybe he can exorcise his own. McIlvaney is an extraordinary writer, smart, cynical, and pithy. He crystallizes character and mood in tight paragraphs that you want to memorize. For instance, when Laidlaw meets a bunch of upper-class boors, he diagnoses their problem as urbane deprivation. He says, "Your attitudes are so glib and self-assured and automatic, you lose the necessary naivete that is living. That way, you eat everything and taste nothing." I found myself reading McIlvaney not only for the story, but for the education. Strange Loyalties has already collected a lot of those glowing reviews that call it more than just a crime novel. The sentiment is right, but the cliché faulty. By definition, crime novels have always been about more than just crime. Instead, they've used crime as an occasion to meditate on sin, doubt, betrayal, and sometimes redemption. Laidlaw's highbrow hobby of reading philosophy isn't just a gimmick. It's McIlvaney's way of reminding us that, at bottom, both good detectives and good philosophers must go down those same mean streets to penetrate the shadowy mysteries of human nature.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Strange Loyalties by William McIlvaney. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Bob Alls, and Ron Barron. Roberta Shurrock directs the show, with assistance today from Sue Spolin. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On June 11th, Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer will turn in her uniform after 30 years of service in the U.S. Army. She's being discharged because she's a lesbian. Colonel Kammermeyer will challenge the military's exclusion of homosexuals in federal court. We'll talk with her on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.
...73 degrees in Center City, Philadelphia.